So, thank you for letting me come to this nice workshop and giving me the opportunity to present this stuff. Some of you have seen some of this before. Indeed, some of you actually authored some of the things I'm gonna talk about. So, please feel free to go to sleep and check your email in the first part of the talk. The second part, however, is about water ice, and that's all new. I think it's probably helpful to go over the quantum spinite stuff, both in terms of context and because that is proper LS matter. I probably don't need to keep showing this slide much longer, but just in case you're not sure where Okinawa is, it's situated close to large typhoons down here off the coast of Asia. It's a subtropical island. I'm part of an attempt to create an English language graduate university in Japan, which is an incredibly ambitious thing to do. Frankly, you would not hire me to teach in Japanese, but that's another story. And in fact, a few of you did visit us last year when we organized a workshop. George would like me to point out that he did not drink all of this bottle. Though there were some other empty bottles around, which are okay, so on to the subject. I'm kind of assuming that in this audience, spin ice needs little introduction. If you follow Big Bang Theory, you'll be aware that it's out there. And people have got quite excited about this as a realization of a lattice gauge theory with monopoles. Recently, actually, it's not so recent, as these things move, a few years ago, there were a little flurry of papers starting to talk about how quantum effects could be explored with spin ice. Again, some of you are in the audience. This is exciting because if you take this classical lattice gauge theory and you quantize it, then you could get a quantum lattice gauge theory which had emergent light, artificial photons. So this is a U1 gauge theory like electromagnetism, but realized by the spins on a lattice and in a very direct way due to spin orbit coupling. So this would be exciting. It's one of the better characterized examples of a spin liquid, and it's one where we know what kind of materials we want to look for it in. However, this is not the beginning of the story. The story, I would say, really begins in August 1933, a year in which Europe was definitely taking a turn for the worse. And these guys in the relatively quiet city of Cambridge were thinking about water. Water ice, in fact, was a rather minor consideration then, though, as you can see from the title of their paper, they were largely interested in the problem of solvation. But while they were doing that, they knocked off how water ice crystals form, and that turns out to be very interesting and very relevant for a lot of what we're doing now. So I want to argue that just as you can make a little snapshot compilation of papers, sorry, go back one on that. You can make a little snapshot compilation of papers with evidence for quantum effects in spin ice. So in the last few years, there've also been a collection of papers suggesting that we should be thinking about similar things in water ice. And in the second part of my talk, I'll talk about some of the implications of that. So this is the story in short, in case you ask lots of questions and I don't get there. From inelastic neutron scattering, there is evidence that there could be collective excitations of protons in some types of water ice. From ab initio calculations, there's evidence that this could be associated with quantum tunneling on hexagonal plaquettes that look a little bit like this, a group of six protons all jumped together. And if you put these things together, you have a lattice gauge theory, which is very much like the one in quantum spin ice, only more complicated. So that's a problem that you can solve, and I'll talk about some of the properties of the solution there. So to give credit where it's due, there's a growing list of collaborators. This is a quite a long-term project, but the two people most important for what I'm going to say are Owen, who did all of the analytic lattice gauge theory calculations, and Olga, who did all of the quantum Monte Carlo simulations. Right, so back to the beginning. Why should you believe in spin ice? Well, you've probably seen this before, but there are heat capacity measurements, now quite celebrated, which at low temperatures find a residual ground state entropy, which is very close to the Pauling estimate of the residual entropy in water ice. And though it's not obviously the same thing, there are neutron scattering studies which see singular features in scattering called pinch points. These are points which are different when you approach them in different directions, which are basically the Fourier transform of a condition like BP equals zero. So the way this extensive manifold of states works is that every tetrahedron in spin ice has two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. That's what gives you the extensive entropy. And if you think of two in, two out as being like div b equals zero, because you have an arrow out for every arrow in, and you Fourier transform it, basically you get that. So these are two equivalent pieces of evidence for the existence of this extensive manifold of states. If you're a close follower of the spin ice literature, there are some very recent experiments which suggest that at very low temperatures this entropy may be lost, but that's a story for another day. So let's say that we do believe in spin ice. So it's very pretty. It has this pyrochlore lattice. And as I've just discussed, two in, two out, div b like equals zero. And this is a prime example of LS matter. I have to get this in now because I'm going to struggle to claim that water ice has strong spin orbit coupling. At the level of the single ion physics, because this is a large moment crystal field split Ising doublet. Okay, so here's my little snapshot of some papers from a couple of years ago saying quantum effects matter. I'm going to single out one of them and ask why people were talking about ytterbium titanate as a quantum spin ice. So ytterbium titanate is rather a lot like holmium titanate or dysprosium titanate. You've just changed the rare earth ion. It's a smaller moment rare earth ion. Quantum effects are much bigger. And there are some very nice inelastic neutron scattering experiments in field which show clear spin wave excitations which can be fit to an anisotropic exchange Hamiltonian. So here's the anisotropic exchange Hamiltonian. Here's the paper that you can read about it in. And if you look at the values of the fits, the biggest interaction is a JZZ. So this is like an Ising interaction between the spins. It's antiferromagnetic, and that means it would enforce this two-in, two-out constraint. And the second biggest interaction is is something which would induce quantum dynamics on top of that. So that quantum dynamics is what gives you the spin wave excitations here, which you can use to parameterize the Hamiltonian. And the parameterization seems to be very good. At least the fits to the spin wave spectra in the field are excellent. Okay, so this was a problem that had been considered at least in the abstract before. In this paper, I wrote down an XXZ model on the pyrochlore lattice. They considered the limit of strong Ising anisotropy, and they argued, correctly, that this can give you tunneling between different spin ice configurations. So to show roughly how this goes, here's a Hamiltonian. Here's a spin ice configuration which is special in as much as that on this plaquette you have a closed loop of spins. And if we single out these two and use this matrix element to swap them like this, and we keep going, with three applications of the Hamiltonian, or an off-diagonal matrix element of the Hamiltonian, we can get back to a state which is a valid spin ice configuration, but where the circulation of these arrows has been reversed. And this trick works for any closed loop of arrows. It doesn't have to be on a hexagonal plaquette, but that's the shortest loop you can consider. You can also think about this as the virtual excitation of monopoles which are running around in the system. So these are color-coded here. This one has three ins and one outs. This one has three outs and one in. Okay, so we have a matrix element between these spin ice states in degenerate perturbation theory, which symbolically we can write like this. And the coefficient, if you do a little bit of combinatorics, turns out to be 12. Okay, so if you take this model, and you use what you know about quantum dynamo models, you realize you can add a term to it which will actually make it exactly soluble. So if we set this extra coefficient mu equal to g, we end up with something which can be written as a projector, and then the ground state, this thing has topological sectors, I'm not going to talk about that, but the ground state in any given topological sector will be the uniform superposition of all states in that topological sector, which turns it into a classical problem where, in fact, you can calculate everything. So the proposed phase diagram for this model has, from these authors, a quantum spin liquid growing out of this exactly soluble point. The exactly soluble point is algebraically correlated, so is the quantum spin liquid, though very slightly differently. So this is an interesting question. I should mention, though I'm not going to review it, that there's an exactly parallel literature for the quantum dynamo model.
Can you say exactly solvable? If you had a two-dimensional lattice, then what you'd get is a six-vertex model.
This is the three-dimensional version of the six-vertex model.
But the three-dimensional version isn't solvable, though.
The two-dimensional version is the three-dimensional version that I should have said you solve on a computer. So, but without approximation, except
right.
A statistical
one. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm using the words less precisely than I should. So, what is this quantum liquid? We've already seen div b equals zero. That's a good step in the direction of electromagnetism. If we write this as b is curl A, and consider then we've taken care of that. If we consider then the effect of our tunneling term, what it's going to do is to make the gauge field vary in time, because the B field is varying in time. If the gauge field is varying in time, then there is an electric field which is associated with that. And the simplest guess you could make is a Maxwell action, or Hamiltonians, if you like, plus signs, where the electric field enters as the time derivative of the gauge field. So this then would support artificial light, or better to say, emergent light photons. So, is there evidence that this works? Yes, there is. Again, authors in the audience. So, these authors considered a problem of frustrated charge order on the pyrochlore lattice, which within a lattice gas mapping is exactly the same thing. And they found very good evidence for a quantum liquid of their hardcore bosons, which you can think of as being the same thing as spins. In finite temperature quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And this actually gives basically quantitative agreement with the predictions of the U1 lattice gauge theory, if you work it out in detail. And I've just covered it up. You can see the lines showing this works. So we came along a little bit later and considered the model which was written down by Hamela et al. We carried out simulations at zero temperature, and we found that the phase diagram which these authors set out is correct, and indeed it's even better than that. This spin liquid grows from the RK point all the way out to the what I'm going to call the physical point of the model, and what they've called the easy axis limit. So this is the point at which you don't need to add an extra term to make the model soluble.
What is Skibble order?
Squiggle order is something so ugly that even its mother couldn't love it. So it's a very complicated state which has a single merit, which is that it contains the maximum number of these flippable plaquettes. And if you view this as a chemical potential for flippable plaquettes and you make it large and negative, that's what you're going to get. So it's analogous to the Kolumna-Dimer order in the Dimer models, but it will play no part in our story. So here, the isentropy, this extensive entropy, has been absorbed into a unique quantum ground state. That's where it's all gone. There are a number of arguments from mean field theory that this state, in fact, is valid for a much wider range of parameters than the kind of limit in which the numerics are carried out, and can therefore be thought of in a much wider range of materials. I'm not going to dwell on this, not least because there will be a whole session on quantum spin ice in the conference next week.
Can I just ask a question, which is, you seem to see a massless phase as you go away from the Roxar-Kittleson point?
You do, yes.
Okay, so you're really not seeing confinement in a compact?
Not in 3D. In 2D, you
do. This is 3D.
This is 3D. Okay, so this is a very important distinction.
Right.
In order to put the water ice in, I've cut everything about 2D out.
Yes, okay, I understand.
In 2D, you expect from Polyakov and others this thing to confine. The numerics that confirm that are now 10 or 12 years old. So immediately you leave the RK point, it confines. In fact, it orders. So in the deconfined three-dimensional case, you get photons. They look like this. And the photons basically wash out the pinch points, or the quantum fluctuations do. So if you looked in neutron scattering at very low temperature, you'd no longer see the pinch point. However, the way in which this connects with classical spin ice, as far as we can tell, is through a crossover. So there is a length scale which separates a long wavelength classical regime from a short wavelength quantum regime. That length scale diverges as you approach zero temperature. And the corollary is that if you come up from zero temperature, you see the classical correlations slowly reasserting themselves as the temperature increases. So what this means is no pinch points to equal zero, but come up in temperature, you thermally excite photons, which create a Debye length, effectively a thermal Debye length, which sets the crossover between the classical and the quantum correlations. As this gets shorter and shorter, you see more and more of the pinch points. So this is, to some extent, a scenario, but it's a scenario which finds good support in quantum Monte Carlo. Here's some very nice recent simulations by Kato-san. Essentially the same model. They've considered parameters for which they can see an XY ferromagnet as well as a spin liquid state. They see basically two anomalies in the heat capacity, one associated going into classical spin ice and another which is a crossover into this quantum spin ice regime. Though, as I've said, it's a crossover, so you can't really say the quantum effects turn on at one temperature. What happens is that you see them at longer and longer length scales as you go down in temperature. And they were able, in fact, to recover the T-cubed behavior in specific heat, which you should get from photons at low temperature, which is nice. And also to calculate some structure factors which show how these correlations evolve as you cool down. And in this regime, even though you're above this crossover scale, in fact you can see quite a lot of hints of the quantum physics at shorter wavelengths. So, over here the system orders. So this is starting to look like quite a well-solved problem. Real materials have long-range dipolar interactions. This is no more than an advertisement for some of our own work, but in fact, you can carry out the quantum Monte Carlo with the long-range dipolar interactions if you're masochistic enough. And you can show that there are both quantum spin liquids and classical spin liquids which survive. Moreover, you can understand the classical ordering problem in the absence of quantum or thermal fluctuations completely, because there's a dimensional reduction from this three-dimensional lattice with long-range interactions onto a triangular lattice with short-range interactions, which is surprising but quite nice. So if you'd like to hear about that, talk to me or read this preprint. Similarly, I'm not going to tell you about the various exciting results in experiment, because you have a session on this next week in the conference. What I'm going to tell you about instead is water ice.
Question.
Yes.
So in simulation, when they look at the dynamical correlation functions, how do they get? They can't do real time dynamics. How do they technically continue with it?
In the interest of me telling my story, and because the people who did the simulations in the audience, I'm going to suggest that you talk to them. So in fact, yes, you do imaginary time dynamics, and there are some clever inferences that you can make from that. So I'm sorry that's not a complete answer to your question, but I will give you a better one afterwards if you like, or you can ask these people.
Actually, notice that we didn't perform an anti-continuation. So,
I'm not saying you did. However, I don't want to have a long discussion about this now.
Everything is equal time.
Yeah. But you can actually infer from the equal time correlations if you take the lattice gauge theory and you integrate it over all energies. So indirectly, you can get a lot of information. This is a technical discussion, which, as I said, I'd prefer not to have right now. So I take no blame for the bad photoshopping here, but it's supposed to get your attention. There are a lot of forms of water ice. Wikipedia seems to have caught up with 17 of them. I think this is not complete. I think the Brigham nomenclature goes up to 20-something, but never mind. We live on this line here, and that's 0 Celsius, so that's the freezing point of water as we know it. And when it freezes, it goes into an hexagonal form of crystal known as ice 1H, or common water ice, or hexagonal water ice. In fact, there are several hexagonal ones. 1H. And you know that normal water ice is hexagonal because you've all seen snowflakes. Okay, so water ice is made of water molecules. Statement the obvious, but actually a bit more than a statement of obvious. It's a molecular solid, which is to say that the water ice molecule, which has quite large electric charges, a very strong dipole moment, and looks quite a lot like Mickey Mouse, retains its integrity inside the water ice crystal. So inside some of these, you have to imagine lots of Mickey Mouse glued together by the ears. So there are strong covalent bonds which hold the molecule together, and then there are much weaker hydrogen bonds which hold these molecules together in a crystal. Now, what's special about the normal hexagonal water ice is that really only the oxygens form a crystal. That's to say, if you take the definition of a crystal out of Ashcroft and Merman or Kittel or whatever your favorite book on solid state physics is, it will tell you that you have a repeating unit. And the oxygen atoms do form a repeating unit, but the protons, the hydrogen atoms, don't. So in fact, they remain disordered. And the reason for this are these ice rules, which are figured out by Bernal and Fowler, that when you connect by hydrogen bonds an oxygen water molecule to four other water molecules around it, which is to say you stick two water molecules on the plus sides here, and you stick two more pluses on the bottom of the minus here, there's no one unique way of doing that. Even once you fix the oxygens to be on this hexagonal lattice, there's still no one unique way of doing that. In fact, there are an exponentially large number of ways of doing that. So this was famously estimated by Pauling, not long after Bernal and Fowler figured out the rules for how it fits together. So this is a desperately strange fact about an incredibly common material. So you go to the cafeteria at lunchtime and maybe get some ice in your drink, and inside it will be a crystal of oxygen with disordered protons all around. Why should you believe this? Well, basically the same pieces of evidence that I showed you for spin ice. So if you take the heat capacity, measure it very carefully down to low temperatures and integrate it up, you get the same kind of residual ice entropy. And if you do neutron scattering on water ice, and this is actually DTO rather than HTO because of the cross-section for neutrons with protons being a bit of an issue, you see nuclear Bragg peaks associated with the oxygen, and the protons you see is this diffuse structure which once again has pinch points. And remember, the pinch points were the Fourier transform of 2 in, 2 out, which here you should interpret as two short covalent bonds and two long hydrogen bonds for every oxygen atom. And if you think about the polarization on those four bonds, two will be pointing in and two will be pointing out. So that, though not the crystal symmetry, is in one-to-one correspondence with the spin ice case. So we have direct thermodynamic evidence and indirect scattering evidence for an extensive manifold of states describing these proton configurations. Is that all? Well, not quite. This slide's gone slightly wrong. Never mind. If we look in spin ice, at any zone center, excepting the middle, which is conveniently excluded here, you will either find nothing or you will find a pinch point. So this is to say that the long wavelength physics is completely controlled by this condition div b equals 0. If you look at zone centers in water ice, you do find pinch points, but here's a perfectly good zone center where there is a broad asymmetric feature. It looks a little bit like a McDonald's M, which is not a pinch point. It's also not a diffuse Gaussian blob, or Lorentzian blob. So it's some strange asymmetric correlation. It's not simple. It's not simple exponential decay in the long wavelength physics. So the ice rules have two consequences, not one, in hexagonal water ice, and that we can understand by thinking about the primitive unit cell, which has four oxygens, and figuring out that actually we only need to specify the vertex configurations at two of these sites, and that we can take odd and even combinations of these. So we basically need, if we want to write down a continuum theory to expand in terms of two fields, a uniform polarization and a staggered polarization. Both are defined inside the unit cell, and this is very much like an antiferromagnet, where we would think about a staggered moment, but if we wanted to completely understand it, we'd also need to think about a uniform moment as well. Once you've got two sites, you can do twice as many things. So skipping quite a few steps, you can write down a continuum field theory to describe this. You find the diffuse scattering at point Q plus little deviation as some form factor, some geometrical factor, dotted with the polarization, and you have to sum over the odd and even channels in the polarization. There are separate constraints on the uniform and the staggered polarization. Surprise, surprise, the constraint on the uniform polarization has the form div p equals zero, so this gives you the pinch points. That's good. And the other one constraint isn't quite so easy to say what it is. It singles out the hexagonal axis z, but you can chase it through and see that this is what gives you the broad asymmetric features in scattering. So this works. Here's a calculation, analytic one, done by a projection method. And here we have contributions of both P plus and P minus. And here we have only contributions of P plus. So we see a pinch point. Here we see a broad asymmetric feature. And both of these features, oh, bugger, I do want to show you that. Both of these features are seen here, pinch point, broad asymmetric feature, and the scattering from water ice. Why am I going on about this? Well, I'm going on about it because when you come to quantize the problem, in fact, both of these fields will matter, which means it will be more complicated than the quantum spin ice case. Can the protons move? Well, we have these nice hexagonal plaquettes, just like the hexagonal plaquettes that we had in the pyrochlore lattice, quantum spin ice, and it would be nice to believe that the protons could hop around those plaquettes from one valid ice configuration, which is to say, from one set of water molecules satisfying the ice rules, to another valid ice configuration, which is to say, another set of water molecules satisfying the ice rules. And there are two of these plaquettes that we need to think about. There's one on the hexagonal symmetry sort of plane and one outer plane. So is there any evidence that we would be justified in writing down the kind of model which has previously been written down for the quantum spin ice case? So happily the answer is yes. There's a variety of evidence which I will present to you now. So this is incoherent, inelastic neutron scattering. If you want to know a lot more about that, please ask Radu. But basically, it's a weak version of scattering in most cases, which is rather strong for the protons in water ice. And it's very, very local. We're really only looking at local correlations here. We're not going to see the pinch points, or not directly. And superimposed here are the incoherent inelastic neutron scattering spectra for ice 1H, which is common hexagonal water ice with the disordered protons, and ice 8, which is a proton-ordered form of this. Now, you see that the line in the middle, which is the presumed elastic line, a few issues with the line shape, but we're not going to talk about those, is the same for both. What differs is that in the proton disordered case, which is this, there's an inelastic signal which extends beyond the elastic line. And the reason the elastic line has a width of a Kelvin is that this is an experiment, not a theory. So counters have a finite energy resolution. So elastic line fits inside the inelastic line for ICE1H, which means that there are excitations of the protons, which are not themselves described by the ICE laws. This is some form of dynamics. So these authors did their homework and then considered the comparison with a partially deuterated ICE1H. And the partial deuteration, in fact, has the effect of driving the system to order. And again, you see restoration of the elastic line. So there's some dynamics which they argue on the basis of form factors must be coming from the protons. It's not oxygen phonons or anything like that, which is present for disordered protons and absent for ordered protons with otherwise the same crystal structure. The oxygens are not changing between these two cases. So they interpret it in terms of tunneling on the hexagonal plaquettes of the lattice, and the reason they do that is that the energy cost for doing anything else is basically an ionization energy. You have to take a water molecule, strip a proton off it, stick it on the end of another water molecule, make two ions and let them run around. This is the same as the monopoles in spin ice. It's really exactly the same thing as the monopoles in spin ice. It's been thought about in these systems for a very long time, since 1933, in fact. And it's energetically very expensive. So their argument is, if you want to do something like this at a low temperature, this experiment's, I think, done at 5 Kelvin, then you better think about collective dynamics that don't cost you this huge ionization energy.
This must be very, very unusual, these tunnelings, because the residual entropy of ice is something from
Okay, yes. This is a very good question, and probably one for discussion at the end. I haven't made slides, but I would be happy to talk about that. It comes back to the things I didn't show about the spin ice, where the residual entropy that everybody is very confident about looks like it, in fact, was out of equilibrium effect at the lowest temperatures. Okay, so why else should you believe in this? Well, in fact, there are a lot of people who work on water ice, though, and water, though not maybe for the reasons that we're getting into it now. And there are some very impressive imaginary time Monte Carlo simulations and molecular dynamic simulations of what goes on in ice crystals. The Monte Carlo particularly has been pushed to the point where people have taken a cluster here of 48 water molecules, fixed the oxygens down somehow, not quite sure how they do that, and looked at how the protons move. The oxygens are actually allowed to wibble around a bit. And what they find, there's a very nice movie, but I couldn't persuade it to play this morning, which shows a plaquette of 6 oxygen atoms with their covalently bonded protons resonating between the two configurations which I showed you for the spin problem. So long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short around the plaquette, resonating to short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. Well, you should understand short is a covalent bond and long is a hydrogen bond. It's a little bit more wiggly in the simulation movie than it is in the cartoon. So what you see is a lot of shaking around of the oxygen atoms, and somewhere in the middle of it you see all the protons together in one go shifting around in a ring, and then together in one go shifting back the other way. So this is really a collective tunneling of the protons. It's not a ionize, run the ionic defect round, eliminate the ionic defect. It's all of them moving together.
So what kind of model they are using to include this quantum effect?
So it's a direct path integral quantum Monte Carlo simulation of the water molecules.
The quantum chemistry model?
Yeah, effectively.
With the 48 water molecules?
and some simplifications, and I'm going to get hazy when it gets on to the simplification. So I will show you the paper and we can look at that later. So, but I take this as a serious attempt to simulate this, and the chemistry community did. It was quite big news in the chemistry literature.
Final temperature simulation?
Yes. So it says imaginary time dynamics. So I can't show you the movie, but what I can show you here is a plot from their paper, which shows coordinates for a whole bunch of protons all shifting at the same moment, and some imaginary time scale associated from tunneling with one configuration to another configuration of one of these plaquettes. So I'll ask you to take my word for it that this is a still from their movie, which is not cooperating today. This is a representation of these protons tunneling together from one configuration to the other. So that's not it. Proton bonding is ubiquitous. Water is ubiquitous. And you can do other things with it. Here's a nice experiment where people put water on the surface of, in fact, sodium chloride. And they made a little ring of four water molecules, brought an SDM tip down, not quite on the middle of this ring, and observed, as a function of now real time, the collective tunneling of the protons, and argued for the same type of tunneling. So long, short, long, short, long, short around the plaquette, tunneling to short, long, short, long, short, long around the plaquette. On a time scale which is, well, long compared with what we're used to, seconds, but measurable. So I have given you some evidence from recent experiments that it's not a crazy thing to do to think about collective quantum tunneling of protons in water ice, or indeed other proton-bonded networks. At this point, it's reasonable to ask what's known or believed about the fact of quantum tunneling in water ice. So this paper sets out a sort of manifesto for why it would be interesting to think about this problem, but doesn't directly address the three-dimensional 1H water ice. So what they do address is 2D planar ice, where they show that you can take a model of a two-dimensional ice, map it onto a compact lattice gauge theory. You end up, in fact, then with a non-compact lattice gauge theory, which you map onto continuum field theory, which looks like this. And as according to expectations, this orders, which is to say that the quantum fluctuations, the kind of collective tunneling on plaquettes that I've been talking about in two dimensions, leads to an ordered ground state, which is not a big surprise, as in fact numerical evidence for that predates the theory. They then go on to talk about three-dimensional, notionally cubic ice, and say this could be really interesting because you could get a zero temperature confinement deconfinement transition. And this note looks a lot like the phase diagram from Kato-san simulations, which I showed earlier, or equivalently the Banerjee simulations. And then you could have a finite temperature phase transition between an ordered state and a disordered state. So this is presented on general, it would be reasonable to expect ground. There isn't a substantial calculation to go with this, but it's interesting, and it probably was reasonable to expect it, because the 3D qubit case has now been explored in considerable depth in the context of quantum spin ice, and indeed you do find a phase diagram rather like this. However, it doesn't tell you per se what happens in the ice 1H, the hexagonal water ice, which is the one that you normally experience and the one that these experiments carried out on. So the model we need to solve is, well, effectively the same model, but now with a hexagonal lattice and two distinct tunneling matrix elements. So we have to allow for two free parameters. And this time we're not going to introduce anything to make it soluble. We're just going to take that. We can turn this into a lattice gauge theory following the now fairly standard prescription of writing this as a spin problem, introducing a gauge field through that. And we end up with basically two copies of what we had before for quantum spin ice. And now I come back to my comment about the effectively two-site unit cell and needing odd and even combinations of the polarization to understand the diffuse scattering. You're also effectively going to need odd and even combinations of things here. This means that when you come to calculate the photons which are associated with this lattice gauge theory, you get a lot more structure. Specifically, you see both linearly dispersing photons. I apologize for the dots. This is a PDF rendering problem, not a piece of physics. Linearly dispersing, but at least if you stay away from the hexagonal symmetry axis, the dispersion of the photon now depends on its polarization. So the two polarizations of the emergent photon have been split. And if we look at the zone center here, we'll see that we don't just have low energy, long wavelength photons. We also have an optical mode. So you can show explicitly, I'm not going to, would make a nice blackboard talk maybe, but not today, that if you quantize the fluctuations of the uniform polarization, you get photons. And if you quantize the fluctuations of the staggered polarization, you get these gapped optical modes. So we can understand the long wavelength features of the microscopic solution from the kind of continuum field theory that we use to understand the classical scattering.
What's the energy scale of this problem?
Good question. It's in units of square root u and k.
It's uk.
This is not a political statement. Okay, so we started from this microscopic model acting on proton configurations. And we mapped it through a fairly now well-trodden path onto two copies of electromagnetism, like this. And the U and the K are the parameters of the field theory. And these are subject, in the course of this mapping, to various renormalizations, which we have not characterized. But we know this works for quantum spin ice. You have to work quite hard to find out what these coefficients are as a function of these. There's not much point because we don't know what these coefficients should be anyway.
In reality, what energy scale are we talking about here?
So, will you accept ab initio for reality or not?
Well, not the reality. I mean, give us some.
So, the scale is a Kelvin.
Electron volt or
the scale is a Kelvin.
Kelvin.
So, this is from a DFT ab initio estimate. Where they don't provide an awful lot of information about how they've calculated it. Well, that's a polite way of putting it. So, if you ab initio a Kelvin, but I'm not sure how to substantiate that. And from experiment, if you look at the wings of scattering on Bove's experiment, that's a tenth of a millielectron volt, which is also a Kelvin. So, the ab initio estimate is consistent with the scale of the inelastic dynamics observed in experiment, but I'm not going to pretend that this is super well characterized. There's nothing like the high field neutron scattering in a ytterbium Titan 8 to fit parameters to. So
the STM experiment that shows this
time very scale. Very long time scale.
And what temperature does STM experiment?
Blah, pass. Don't know. I can look it up at the end, but I can't remember.
And there is only one kind of spin-ons and monopoles. What aren't in this case?
I think the answer is yes in terms of the charge defects, Well, you can fold them up into one. So I think it's the uniform polarization which distinguishes the charges, and you have two ionic defects. The reason I'm sort of hesitating a bit is that in water ice you also have another type of defect, which is a double-loaded proton, two protons and one bond. Seems like crazy chemistry to me, but people believe in it. And I'm not quite sure how you put this into the gauge theory.
It looks like it's got two independent gauge flow. This way I can define two concurrent gauge charges.
So yeah, I see where you're coming from. I don't think that's the case, but I...
Then somehow these two gauge flow are not totally independent.
Right. Yeah. So that's the... I think that's the correct way of thinking about it. And I think in terms of charges, it's the uniform polarization you need to think about, because they are the point sources. You get point sources of point sinks of uniform polarization associated with the Arnott defects. So the Arnott defects are well characterized. You basically take one hydrogen, you move it onto another water molecule, you have one negative charge and one positive charge. The double-loaded bonds and empty bonds are a bit harder to think about. But maybe that can be done too. Okay, so I showed you the photons. I showed you
this. Intensity is a density correlation function.
This is a bit better than that. This is the dynamical structure factor for inelastic neutron scattering of neutrons or X-rays from the density of protons. So we've put all the form factors in for the protons on the bonds. So this is roughly what it would look like in an experiment if it had been measured. So diffuse scattering, I've talked about this. Here was the classical theory that we did for the diffuse scattering. Here's the pinch point. Here is the quantum theory. Can see that, well, the pinch points wash out, as in quantum spin ice, and these broad asymmetric features end up a bit smudgy. I can't really describe it better than that.
This equal time correlation?
This is the energy integrated equal time correlations. So I'm not showing it, but we have checked this in variational Monte Carlo, and we find that the variational Monte Carlo agrees essentially exactly with the field theory again. So this is fairly well substantiated as a piece of theory. So if you make pretty pictures, you can compare the classical and quantum cases in various planes and see how that evolves. So I'm not presenting it, as I just said to you back. We've checked both the classical and the quantum cases against simulation at finite size, and the field theories work in both cases quantitatively.
What's the temperature?
That was zero temperature. This is now 5 Kelvin. So I now want to compare with the Bove experiment. So if you look up in a book what the incoherent inelastic neutron scattering cross-section is and calculate the appropriate response function, it looks like this, and you get little Van Hove singularities coming from the photon dispersion and stuff, but fine. It's got some sharp structure. What it hasn't got is a lot of weight at zero energy because the quantum fluctuations have washed that out. So if you take this, convolute it with a Gaussian of about the width of the Bove elastic line, and add in that Gaussian again as a representation of the elastic line, then you find some wings. They're not quite as wide as the wings in experiment, but they're qualitatively rather similar. So I'm not going to pretend that this is a solved problem, but it's at least encouraging that you find dynamics which qualitatively at least reproduce the wings of scattering seen in an experiment. You can mess around with trying to make more precise line shapes, but that seems to be unrewarding. Where does that leave us? So we've used a combination of analytic field theory and numerical simulations, which I haven't really talked about, to characterize both the classical and the quantum correlations in hexagonal water ice, considering, I should say, only really the disordered proton case. We find that in quantum water ice, you get a U1 lattice gauge theory, somewhat more complicated one than in quantum spin ice, with photons, emergent photons, which are now birefringent, so the dispersion depends on the polarization. And we have a putative explanation for the wings of incoherent and elastic scattering seen in these experiments. So where next? Well, water ice is very strange and beautiful and very much still at the frontiers of research in a whole wide range of fields. Proton correlations have actually been studied for almost 100 years, but there's quite a lot which is still not understood about them. And in many cases, and this is maybe the most encouraging thing, the modern techniques, the ones that we're used to in experiment and theory on the frustrated magnetism LS matter side, have not really been applied. So whether or not this scenario turns out to be right, there's almost certainly more to be discovered. And encouragingly, proton bonding is even more ubiquitous than water ice. So there's other things to think about too. So sorry for going on slightly long. Thank you for your attention.
A little bit late, so we have time for maybe two or three questions. Yeah, Tom?
So if we've got thermal entropy on this...
I promised to say something about entropy, didn't I? Yes.
Sorry,
yes.
If one plots just a thermal entropy of quantum water ice, so that initially it will... So obviously, at zero temperature, it will be zero. And but at some point, it should look like this.
So it should come up as T cubed from zero, because you have linearly dispersing photons.
Right.
Then you get a Schottky-like anomaly,
right.
And then the heat capacity will come back down again. And if you have a well-defined classical ice state, you'll get a rather boring region where not much is going on,
right.
Because entropy
is
not changing.
So what is that temperature where you see this falling? So
for this problem, unknown. For the quantum spin ice problem, it's of order this tunneling matrix element, and the peak is a little bit lower than the bare tunneling matrix element. I think it's about 0.7, 0.8. Can you remember?
But no one has explored this crossover from T cubed to the Pauling experiment.
Well, it has been explored in the quantum spin ice case. The finite temperature simulations have not been done for the hexagonal, the more complicated case. And remember, there are two parameters now, and we don't know what either of them are, except that
right.
We believe by order of magnitude
don't
matter.
Just about the water ice.
Yeah.
Experimentally, no one has tried.
So right. So this is the second half of the question. So water ice, there are experiments down to about half a Kelvin, which is not really low enough in terms of if you're thinking about dynamics at a fraction of a Kelvin. Those do not see an anomaly like the Schottky anomaly in the simulations of quantum spin ice. So there is no, maybe I should have made a slide of this, there's no thermodynamic evidence for a crossover. However, the temperatures at which they measured are not desperately low. And the lesson of the spin ice was that the equilibration times at very low temperatures quickly go into weeks and months. So people have remeasured dysprosium titanate, waiting a week at the low temperatures for the sample to equilibrate, and watching the flow of heat out of it. And they found a completely different heat capacity curve at low temperatures from the celebrated results of Ramirez et al. And they, in fact, maybe see the onset of order or some kind of anomaly at low temperatures which hadn't been seen before. So my inference is you'd really want somebody to go back and measure the water ice extremely carefully, going to a rather lower temperature and being very, very patient about the equilibration before you drew any conclusion one way or the other. It's quite probably not an equivalent.
Yeah, so it is a related comment. So for the this holmium pattern, you show the pinch point, observation
yeah.
Pinch point in the experiment. But actually, there is an argument by Rodley that energy scale, temperature scale is too high if we consider the energy scale of the exchange coupling for the holmium pattern. So the it's kind of acceptable. And the reason why for the observation is mostly like in
due to disorder effects. And so if you have more disorder, then you might have larger temperature.
I don't know how you get pinch points out of disorder.
Yeah, actually, there's an argument. And so I ask about the case of the wood ice. So is there any experimental?
Well, I showed you the experimental evidence. It's the same two pieces of evidence for the pinch points, which have been seen in a variety of scattering experiments. And there are the there's the heat capacity measurements, which clearly down to 4 Kelvin, you do recover a residual entropy. And 4 Kelvin is reasonably cold for water ice. It does prove.
I've got just a yes or no question.
One last question.
Okay. Is there no evidence of a massive phase in 3 dimensions of any of the systems? Of water ice?
That's like a double negative, so I'm not sure how to answer.
Is there evidence? So you only seem to see a massless phase?
No, you can tune your model and see a massive phase if you want to. That was the squiggle state.
Okay.